I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Last spring, the little-known National Counterterrorism Center was granted sweeping new powers to collect large amounts of data on U.S. citizens, even people suspected of no crime, and then analyze it for suspicious patterns. Well, the changes represent a major break with previous policies and have been likened by critics to the Department of Pre-Crime in the film Minority Report. Joining us now is senior technology reporter for The Wall Street Journal, Julia Angwin, who has been following the story. Julia, welcome back to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
And where are you calling in from?
I'm at a privacy conference in Boulder, Colorado.
At a privacy conference?
Yes. Privacy is everywhere, or nowhere.
Well, I bet that the National Counterterrorism Center knows exactly where you are right now. So if I were a part of that, I could probably just look you up and see you on a map at this very moment. This is a very good segment for all of our paranoids in the audience. And if you're not paranoid, you will become paranoid after hearing Julia speak for a little bit, I can assure you. First of all, I don't think that the National... I'm a big Homeland fan, so I know about CIA, but I know a little bit about the FBI. But I don't think the National Counterterrorism Center is a department of the government that most people know that much about. Could you give us a little background on how this department came together and what it does or is supposed to do?
Yeah, so basically after 9/11, you know, there was a lot of interest in making sure that the intelligence agencies didn't have another failure like that. As you probably recall, you know, there was some intelligence about some of the hijackers that didn't make it to the right people in the intelligence community or make it far enough through the chain in order to catch them before they were able to strike. And so after 9/11, President Bush said, you know, we need some sort of new agency that will integrate all the intelligence across the CIA, FBI, NSA, all our intelligence community, Department of Homeland Security, and be sort of the eyes and ears across all of that intelligence to make sure we don't miss any of these connections. So he started in 2004, there was a law passed reforming the intelligence community, and that was when the National Counterterrorism Center was created. It is not that well known, though. It's still rather new by Washington agency standards.
Well, I remember at the time there was a lot of talk about the intelligence community's failure to connect the dots. That was the term that was always used. And there was also a lot of talk of internecine warfare between the different intelligence collecting agencies. And wasn't the NCTC supposed to kind of coordinate that better and make sure that, you know, all the information was lining up better?
Yes, their mission is really connect the dots. And so they and they also were supposed to deal with this internecine warfare issue by having all the different intelligence agencies commit their own employees. So a lot of the people who work at NCTC are actually on loan from other agencies. Mm-hmm. The idea being that if they all sat together, they would learn to collaborate and share information and bring that back with them when they go back to their agencies. And by all accounts, that sort of collaborative piece of it has worked. The question about connecting the dots is a harder question to answer because NCTC is sort of, we don't know whether they've succeeded or not, but there was one well-known case where we failed to connect the dots with this Christmas Day bomber in 2009.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we're talking about collecting the dots, I seem to recall that the Department of Homeland Security also had a similar function or supposed function. Is that true? Is there overlap between these two agencies?
There's a lot of overlap in the intelligence mm-hmm. community. So there are, you know, there's a counterterrorism center at the CIA, for instance, who are the people who track down Osama bin Laden, right? And then there's National Counterterrorism Center, which is supposed to connect the dots between all those counterterrorism centers. And then the Homeland Security has fusion centers that are at the state and local level, connecting the dots of state and local intelligence. And so there is a lot of dot connecting going on.
And there's also, I mean, we never hear about the NSA in any of this either. I mean, the NSA has this huge budget, but the public never hears about what the NSA is up to.
Right. So So theoretically, the NSA is only collecting information, foreign intelligence, right? So, and some of this connecting the dots stuff I'm talking about was counterterrorism, which sometimes meant, you know, domestic. So in theory, NSA is listening in on all the calls and emails of people overseas and trying to figure out which one of them have bad intents towards the U.S. There's been some controversy about whether they may have overstepped their bounds of whether they could tap onto domestic things, and occasionally they get rapped on the hand for that. But their mandate hasn't actually sort of dramatically changed post 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Before I ask you about this new these new powers that the NCTC has acquired, I just have to ask, what is the oversight of the NCTC? Who has oversight of this agency? Like, how would we as American citizens know what the NCTC is up to a point at least?
So the NCTC reports to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which was a new, also a new thing created in 2004. So the head of the of that agency reports to the president. So
okay.
Basically, that was John Brennan until he's now nominated for the CIA. But basically, that position oversees the NCTC is the primary agency that reports up to the Office of Directorate of National Intelligence.
But there's no congressional oversight.
Well, no, Congress obviously oversees all of this stuff. So
okay.
All of these intelligence committees are answerable to Congress ultimately.
Okay.
Congress funds them, and Congress is supposed to get reports about their activities and make sure that they're obeying the laws and not overstepping their bounds.
Okay. All right. So now this new program, these powers were given to the NCTC last spring, and you described this program as, your words are, a government dragnet. So they're able to comb through lots of records of things that we law-abiding people do. What kind of records are fair game for the National Counterterrorism Center?
Well, so what, I mean, there's things we know and things we don't know.
You sound like Rumsfeld.
Right now. I do. I'm sorry. Rumsfeld, really, he brought us a great, you know, turn of phrase with the known unknowns.
Known unknowns. Well, tell us about the known unknowns.
Okay.
Then we'll move on to the unknown unknowns.
Right. So what we know is that the National Counterterrorism got sweeping new powers to collect data from other government agencies. So basically, prior to these new rules, the NCTC had the right to say, you know, I have heard that Andy Borowitz is a possible terrorist, and they would go to different government agencies and say, pull Andy's files and give them to me as part of our Connect the Dots program. You know, we're going to connect all the dots of all these different agencies who might otherwise not have gotten their act together to pull Andy's files, right? And then basically at NCTC, they would have sort of a comprehensive Andy report, and they would look at, across all this data and say, is he or is he not a suspect? After these guidelines came out in March, they actually now... It was hard for them, sometimes technically, to go get all this data about Andy from different places. So now they have the right to just pull all data that all those agencies have into their database, and then whenever they need to look through it for Andy or for anything else they want to look through, it's already there. And so they've already copied the entire databases of other federal government agencies, 5 years' worth of data they're authorized to get. It is not clear what data is walled off from them. Certain agencies, for instance, the IRS or Census, have laws that protect how their data is shared. And there would probably be some legal discussions that have not yet taken place, likely, about whether that data could be copied over to the NCTC. But there's nothing that is not that is totally walled off in this.
I'm Andy Borowitz, and I'm in for Leonard Lopate here on WNYC and WNYC.org. I am talking to the Wall Street Journal's Julia Angwin about what the National Counterterrorism Center is doing with its sweeping new powers. Now, you know, I always think that if these people, these agencies, really want to know everything about every American citizen, they should just go on Facebook, where we seem to give away all of our most private information for free for no good reason. But actually, a lot of companies are, you know, private enterprises getting into the business of big data analytics. And they're trying to figure out you know, what our behavior means, who's better off marketing to us, and all of that. Are these are these same sort of behavioral metrics being used by something like the NCTC to determine not that what we're going to buy, but whether or not we might be terrorists and what we might be up to of a nefarious nature?
I mean, yes, this is a good question. So big data is hot. Everybody's talking about big data and how you can use it to predict the future. And, you know, certainly companies are trying to do it, and so is the government. And so the NCTC has, in the spring enhancement of its powers, it got the authority to do what they call pattern-based queries. So previously they had to have some reason to suspect you, Andy, before they pulled their files. But now they might just say, you know, we're interested in men of a certain age who have recently shopped for a golf club and drive a certain kind of car because we've gotten a tip that or we have some reason to believe that that might be a terrorism pattern, right? And so then that is moving slightly more into the world you're talking about, which is sort of big data analytics. The National Counterterrorism Center says they are not currently doing that type of query, but they have won the right to do that query, which was previously explicitly prohibited in their mandate.
Mm-hmm. And that just changed in the spring with these new new powers. Is there any evidence, you know, that any of this predictive patterning even works? Because, you know, just to get back to the Facebook analogy, when I'm on Facebook, I always see the ads that Facebook thinks will appeal to Andy Borowitz, and they never do. I've never clicked on a Facebook ad in my entire life. So is this predictive patterning, could it be any more useful? Is it useful at all? Is there any evidence that it even works for private enterprise?
You know, that's a very good question, and that's really one of the main questions of our time, really. I mean, everybody's throwing all this money into analyzing big data, but, like, does it actually work? We don't know. I think that there is certainly it's true that things like credit card fraud, big amounts of data about credit card transactions, you know, the credit card companies have actually done a very good job of using that to predict and weed out fraud almost as soon as it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so almost everybody's had the experience of your credit card company calling you, and they usually catch these transactions after one or two within minutes or hours. And so that is a very impressive use of big data analytics for predictive purposes. However, that is a situation where there's thousands and thousands of data points per minute, right? In terrorism, there just aren't a lot of terrorist incidents, right? So, and each one is different. So first time there's a shoe bomber, then there's an underwear bomber. So the problem is that there aren't, and the terrorist incidents look different. So you build a pattern around shoes, and then all of a sudden you have to build a new one for underwear. So there have been a lot of data scientists who have argued that predictive pattern queries don't work for things that are rare events like terrorism. But that is a debate that's ongoing and, you know, could change as maybe there's more data available or computers get smarter or whatever. So it's not a settled issue, but it's certainly one that is open to question.
This is Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. We're at WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Julia Angwin about why the National Counterterrorism Center has been granted powers allowing it to collect information on Americans, even if they haven't been suspected of a crime. And we'll have more with Julia after a break. On the next Science Friday, can we kill cancers by attacking their genetic weaknesses? Join Ira Flatto for a look at how doctors are using genetics to uncover new ways to treat cancer. Today at 2 on 93.9 FM, WNYC. I'm Andy Borowitz, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by Roundabout Theater Company, presenting Picnic, written by William Inge and directed by Sam Gold, now in previews. Tickets and more information at roundabouttheater.org. TechServe, celebrating 25 years of offering Apple products, service, and integrated technologies. TechServe, make stuff happen. New York Public Radio's Community Advisory Board wants your feedback. Come to a public meeting to share your thoughts about WNYC. Monday, January 14th at 7 at the Green Space, 44 Charlton Street. Details at 646-829-4000 or WNYC.org.
Next time on The Takeaway, the storm over Sandy relief continues in the Northeast and in Washington, D.C. The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick and WNYC's Bob Henley on how to spell disaster relief in the wake of Sandy and lessons learned from past storms. Next time on The Takeaway.
This afternoon at 3 on 93.9 FM WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, WNYC and WNYC.org, and I am talking to The Wall Street Journal's Julia Angwin about the new sweeping powers of the National Counterterrorism Center. So, Julia, I promised, when we were talking before that I would stoke everyone's paranoid fears, and I don't feel I've done that enough, so we're going to move on to that segment of the interview. Are you game for that?
I'm happy to help.
All the way from your secret meeting in Boulder.
I'm paranoia central here.
In your underground lair. So now, when there were changes to these powers that came back, that came through in the spring, part of the changes dropped the requirement that the center discard the data of innocent people. Now, did the officials at the NCTC aggressively push for that rule change? They're holding on to all of our data even though we're innocent.
Yes. I mean, one of the problems that the NCTC said it was facing was that they wanted to be able to copy these entire databases. So, for instance, DHS, when you fly, the Department of Homeland Security has a thing about, you know, you took this flight overseas, you came back on this date, et cetera. They have some information in there. The National Counterterrorism Center wanted, for instance, that entire database. And previously, they would have had to delete innocent people's data. If they copied the entire database, they would be able to look through it for 30 days, and then they would have to throw away all the innocent people's information. They said that that was too burdensome for them because it was really hard to throw it away, mostly because they said they couldn't always tell whether somebody was innocent, right? You might seem innocent now, but in the future, you might seem less innocent.
Right.
So there's this concern they had about throwing away the data. And I think as anyone who's ever collected data, I mean, even I, as a reporter, I probably hang on to my notes too long. Like, I can understand that feeling of wanting to hang on to something for future use, even if you don't use it. But when you're talking about people who are not suspected of a crime, remaining in a terrorism database and remaining basically suspects because their authority now allows them to continuously reanalyze your innocence for 5 years, it raises a lot of questions about what kind of surveillance we're willing to allow domestically of people without any suspicion.
Well, can I bring up a troublesome area, which is the whole U.S. Constitution thing?
Yes, please do.
I just thought somebody ought to mention that. It's we've been talking a lot about the Second Amendment these days, and of course that's a very important amendment. But the First Amendment allows me to talk about the Fourth Amendment, which I'd like to discuss with you now. The Fourth Amendment, for those of us who don't remember, I certainly don't remember all the amendments, it addresses probable cause for searches and seizure. But I do remember probable cause from The Wire. So that's my
right.
memory of that, and also from Homeland. So you have to have some sense that there's a reason to search somebody and to delve into their stuff. Has the government discovered some kind of loophole that allows, you know, allows you to sort of circumvent the whole Fourth Amendment thing? Is that what's...
Now, that would be a great story for me. Newly discovered Constitution loophole. so here's the sad thing about the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment requires the government to have probable cause when searching your house, your papers, your effects. However, in this particular case, you know, the data that the government stores about you in their files is not your house, your papers, your effects. It's actually stored with the government. So under the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Fourth Amendment for the past 30 years, they've basically interpreted that things that aren't stored in your home, things that you store with Google, things you store in the cloud, things that are the government has on you, those files are not protected by the Fourth Amendment. And so that's been an issue in all sorts of areas. There was a Supreme Court case last year about GPS surveillance that touched a little bit on this issue. And so that, unfortunately, is the the problem here, that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to the data the government already has about you. But in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan actually, when he was starting, he wanted to start looking for communist infiltrators in the U.S. He got some pushback from the intelligence community who said, you know, spying on innocent U.S. people is not a good idea. And so he put in place some guidelines for the intelligence community saying that generally when you do domestic surveillance, you need to have some reasonable suspicion before investigating someone.
Mm-hmm.
And so those guidelines, they're not the same as the Fourth Amendment. They're not as strong. But those have been the prevailing guidelines for the intelligence community. And that's why this memo that the NCTC, this legal guidelines, they've gotten these new powers, are a reversal of that general philosophy that was established by President Reagan.
Well, what was the general philosophy that Reagan established? Is that a law? Is that on the books?
It's an executive order.
Oh, okay. So they can reverse that.
Yeah. So the executive order still stands, and the memo that the National Counterterrorism Center operates under is the Attorney General's interpretation of how that executive order applies to the NCTC's operations. And so they've interpreted the Counterterrorism Center's behavior as complying with those guidelines.
So according to these new powers that the NCTC has, they're allowed to look at any of our information that's in the Federal Register. Is that correct?
No, sorry. That. So the Federal Register is so Federal Register is just a digest that the government publishes about new rules and regulations. But the Federal Register in this particular instance serves as sort of the privacy policy. So, when you go to a website, there's a privacy policy. So now the idea, and you're theoretically supposed to read that and decide whether you want to do business with this website. In this situation, the Federal Register serves as the place where government agencies post their, quote, privacy policy. So they would say, post something on the Federal Register saying, you know, our data that we collect about you is shared with these people, and might be shared with, you know, counterterrorism people. And so in theory, you as a consumer, or before you would do business with the government, would go look up that policy and decide whether you want to, you know, engage with that government agency. In many cases, that's just an unrealistic expectation.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate today on WNYC and WNYC.org, and I'm speaking to The Wall Street Journal's Julia Angwin about the National Counterterrorism Center's sweeping new powers to investigate us all. Now, these policy changes were very contentious within the Obama administration. This was very heavily debated. Who was in favor of this, and who was opposed to it?
When the changes were first proposed within the administration, there was a big debate about whether these new powers were going too far. And people who were leading the charge against these changes were the chief privacy officers at the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice. And it's interesting that those are the two agencies that led the charge, because as anyone who's gone through a TSA full body screening knows, it's not as if the Department of Homeland Security is like super into your privacy, right? So the fact that they were the ones who said, you know, this is crossing the line.
This is going too far.
Right. It's a marker because they are the ones who actually are seeing your naked private parts.
Wow. Well, you say that a former senior White House official described the changes as breathtaking. In what ways? That's a pretty strong term.
It's true that they are, though, kind of breathtaking when you read the new powers, because they say things like, for instance, that the National Counterterrorism Center can not only copy an entire government database and keep it for 5 years looking through the records for terrorism clues, can actually also send that entire database to a foreign government.
What?
And ask that foreign government for help looking through it for terrorism clues. You know, which is kind of an incredible thing, right? So not only are they going to take your data, but in case they can't figure it out themselves, they might send it to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So that really is sort of opening a whole new can of worms. Now, there was controversy under the Bush administration for something they called, and I'm so sorry, we had the author George Saunders with us earlier today, and I'm so sorry that he didn't invent this term, The Total Information Awareness Program. I mean, that just sounds like something out of a George Saunders story. First of all, I love that name, but how is what the National Counterterrorism Center doing now what was the Total Information Awareness Program, and how is this new program different from that?
So in the Total Information Awareness Program was proposed right after 9/11 by this group called DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is basically like the research arm of the Pentagon. And in, you know, the wake of the terrorism attacks on 9/11, you know, they were trying to think outside the box, which is their job, to be the outside-the-box thinkers, of how to prevent such things. And so they came up with this idea, let's collect every single bit of information about every single person in the U.S., their credit card transactions, their internet browsing behavior, and all their government records, put them all in one giant database, mix and match it, and then we'll be able to find the terrorists. Well, as soon as they proposed this idea, you know, everybody went crazy. Congress defunded them. The guy who proposed it had to retire, and it was immediately quashed. That program, interestingly, was just a proposal to develop such a thing, right? So what the National Counterterrorism Center has done is developed such a thing with one difference, which is they are not proposing to get all the commercial data, the credit card transactions, the internet browsing behavior. They are only talking about the data with all the government agencies. But if you think about the government, you know, if you go to a Veterans Administration hospital or you go deal with the Department of Homeland Security for travel, I mean, there are a lot of, and the IRS, there's so many ways that we interact with the government. It's still quite a bit of data.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the Obama administration has kind of codified some of the domestic surveillance regime that was in place at the end of the Bush second term, and in some ways even expanded it. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that is true. I mean, if you think about the National Counterterrorism Center as a case study, the Bush administration had much tighter reins on them, and it's the Obama administration that loosened those reins. And you know, people in favor of those changes inside the administration would tell you it's because technology has changed and the challenge has changed, and that we need to copy this data because too hard to do the queries and technical reasons, right? So they'll talk about technical efficiency reasons, not policy reasons. But the effect on the ground is that you and I are much more likely to be an object of domestic surveillance than we were, you know, just a few years ago.
Why do you think that that the NCTC has stayed so far out of the public view? I mean, I've got to tell you, I do remember hearing that there was going to be this super agency to connect the dots, but the NCTC really is not something we hear reported about very much.
Yeah, I mean, it is really remained under the radar. The head of the NCTC doesn't speak publicly too much. You know, they have an unmarked campus.
Where is their campus?
It's in McLean, Virginia. It's not too far from the CIA, but unlike the CIA, which has 10 different signs like CIA, turn right here, you know. This one is really like tucked away. It's an unmarked building and in a residential neighborhood. You'd have to know where you were going to get there. So they've, I think, kept a low profile, it seems like, in a deliberate fashion, possibly because they think that this is their new competitive weapon in the terrorism wars.
Here's something else that struck me. This all that you described is very troubling, but then this thing is really a killer, that the National Terrorism Center also has the power to depart from any of these guidelines in an emergency. What is an emergency,
and who
defines it? Because my idea of an emergency is a little different. You know, when Time Warner Cable doesn't show up, that's an emergency. But
right.
But what do they think is an? I mean,
that might be their emergency too. No,
is there what in the language of their is it their? You know, in this new set of guidelines, how do they define an emergency?
It's not defined, and that's one of the things that people, you know, who have raised questions about these guidelines have said, is that the guidelines themselves are so sweeping and so broad and so undefined that it really could mean anything. And the thing that's hard about these guidelines in particular is the fact that there isn't an oversight mechanism, right? There's no going to court to get an agreement that that's an emergency, right? So what's interesting is that a lot of surveillance has very strict rules. So you've heard of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. It's a special court where electronic surveillance has to go for special approval to a board of federal judges, and sometimes they say yes and sometimes they say no. In this case, though, there's no such mechanism. It's just that they might have to go to their bosses, the Office of the Directorate of National Intelligence. In some cases, there's a bit of oversight from the Inspector General of the intelligence community. But other than that, it's really a self-policing.
I see, self-policing. Well, that was not reassuring to me at all. But I asked you for the truth. And I guess what all this means is that even if I go home and clear my Google history, that won't help either. They've got everything.
Yeah, like I said, you know, they haven't actually started. They haven't said they're doing anything about commercial data, Google browsing history. But, you know,
but in an emergency,
silent on that.
In an emergency,
anything
my Google
could
history is fair game. Well, thanks for alarming us all, as promised. I've been speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Julia Angwin. We've been talking about the federal government's terrorism data collection program and the expanded powers that were recently given to the National Counterterrorism Center. Julia, enjoy Boulder, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Leonard returns for Monday's show. He'll speak to Ping Fu about her remarkable journey escaping the Chinese Cultural Revolution to become an entrepreneurial leader in the United States. Then National Book Award winner Deirdre Baer discusses her new biography of the iconic New Yorker artist Saul Steinberg. Also, we'll get a preview of the Public Theater's Under the Radar Festival. Plus, Glenn Crosten on how we misinterpret risk. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Lindsay Hodges and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. Ryan Nehru was at the audio controls. I'm Andy Borowitz, in today for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.